Thank you very much, Honourable Chairman.
Just hold on one second, please. Chriselle, can you close that door? Sorry, Kibir, over to you once more.
Thank you, Honourable Chairman. Honourable members, colleagues from the mining industry, my colleagues from De Beers, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'm seeing holding you here for the afternoon, so good afternoon. And if you ask as many questions as you did to Anglo, then good evening to all of you as well. Just introducing my team, my name is Philip Barton. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of De Beers Consolidated Mines Limited. On my left is Sakine Nkobo, who's the Executive Head of PCA, Public and Corporate Affairs. And on my right, Tiger Monoledi. And the Tiger refers to his skills as a golfer and nothing else, as the head of our government relations team. Allow me also to convey the apologies of our executive chairman, Mr. Boren Peterson, who cannot join us today. Boren is currently in Kinshasa, involved with a government delegation in discussing the future of the Kimberley process, which is key to us as a company, De Beers, but also key to the health and the sustainability of the diamond industry going forward. This is where background, De Beers Consolidated Mines is a company that this year turns 123 years old. On that, I would like to address the honourable members sitting across me in terms of the perception that De Beers is leaving South Africa, and I am hoping to dispel that perception during our presentation today. We mine a very special product. A diamond is a special product. It is a sign of emotion, and that emotion mostly is an emotion of love. I hope that everybody in this room is wearing a diamond. I hope that somebody, I see you folding your arms. I hope that somebody has recently demonstrated that emotion of love to you and gave you a diamond.
No.
And for the men amongst us, that you've given your loved one a diamond. And if nobody has given one to you, you know, love yourself enough to reward you with a diamond. So go from here and buy a diamond for yourself. This diamond, this demonstration of an emotion, brings a very special responsibility to us leading this company. Because love is, a diamond is pure, and so is the emotion of love. And that puts a responsibility on us of living up to diamonds. And living up to diamonds means different things to different people. Living up to diamonds may be superior returns for our shareholders, because that is making their diamond dream a reality. Based on the questions that we heard here today, they're living up to diamonds. Fulfilling a diamond dream is going to be very different to somebody sitting in a community, to our employees, and to our other stakeholders. And that is why we as a company are committed to South Africa. We are committed to the problems that we as a country face. And those problems that I don't need to spell out to you are the triplet of poverty, inequality, and unemployment. And I'm hoping that in our presentation on transformation in De Beers and in our efforts to address the terrible triplet, that we will demonstrate our strive to living up to diamonds and be true to the product that we mine. Just as a last point before we start the formal part of the proceedings, again addressed to the honourable member across me, I can assure you that we are not poaching from government, but unfortunately government is poaching from us, and that is a contribution that we gladly make. You know, that is what we see as part of our role, you know, is to train people and get people skills in this country. Tipo, if we can go to slide one, just skip over that one. Just a quick outline of our operations. Starting in the far north of the country, our flagship mine, Venetia, and we'll talk about a 15 billion rand investment that we will be doing at Venetia over the next 8 years. That will secure that mine's future until beyond 2050, and that is one of the aspects that I hope will dispel the notion that De Beers is leaving South Africa. I'm just starting. As we come down, Twisford Mine near Kroonstad, we've reopened that mine in 2006 after building a brand new mine. It's a mine that was closed in 2012. Acquired by De Beers, but never mined by De Beers before. Then we're still very active in the Kimberley Mines area. We've got another couple of years of working on tailings resources. Finch Mine, we're still out there. On the 15th of September, ownership of that mine formally transferred to Petra Diamonds. The Namakwaland Mines, we'll talk about a little bit more later on up at the west coast, and then SASA, which is our South African sea area operation. We employ around about 2,800 people. With the studying of Finch Mine, that number has gone down to just over 2,000 people, 2,100 people. We roughly mine 43 million tonnes. That will be increased to over 60 million tonnes, otherwise stripping profile increases. With Finch as part of the stable mine, about 7.5 million carats per annum, that will reduce by about 1.3 million carats per annum with the sale of Finch mine. Just our DBCM scorecard, and we'll run through this as we go along, many greens there, and then around health and safety and the environment, areas that we still need to do a lot of work on. Then our ownership structure. This received a number of questions in the previous presentation, so I'll deal with it in a little bit of detail. You'll see there our majority shareholders, the Beer Society and an M. That is the Beers Group company registered in Luxembourg. That is owned 40% by the Oppenheimer family, 15% by the government of Botswana, and then 45% by Anglo-American. Now, there was a question about B shares. Anglo-American owns 45% of all of the Beers. The shares are split, the A shares refer to the De Beers' holdings outside of South Africa, and the B shares refer to the holding of the South African assets. So they hold 45% of the B shares, but so also of the A shares. Then we look at our 26% of our broad-based black economic empowerment deal that we did in 2006, and at the time was a fairly groundbreaking structure that we employed. There are two key groups there, the one employees, and on the other side, Panahola Capital, and I'll show you a little bit more about the shareholding of Panahola Capital just now. Let's start with a 35% shareholding in the economic structure, and that's the Equal Allocation Trust. We're not a listed company, so as part of the the VE deal, we mirrored this to units, and 35% of those units are owned by all the employees. So whether it's myself as the Chief Executive apparatus, we each had 6 units in this deal. So again, no discrimination there from, you know, whether you're in management or whether you're at the coal face. In terms of the key employee trust, that is a trust that we've put in place, and those are mostly our more skilled HDSA employees, and that was an attempt on the one side of ownership, but on the other side also to create a retention mechanism of our skilled black employees in our company. If I then go on to the Panaharic Capital side that owns the other 50% of the 26%, that is structured as follows. 3 males in the shareholding, being Manny DiPietro, ex-premier of the Northern Cape, and also the deputy chairman of our company. Warren Peterson. Warren is the chairman of our company. We've seen a while ago that Warren took over from Nicky Oppenheimer when Nicky retired as chairman of De Beers Consolidated Mines. And then Mark Machiti. Mark is chairman of our Governance and Assurance Committee, previously known as our Audit Committee, and also chairman of our Investment Committee. Then we've got 4 ladies that participate through Fiatona Holdings, Cheryl Corollas. Cheryl also sits on the DBCM board. Dolly McCutley. Dolly previously was part of the DBCM Executive Committee. Manny has now taken over that role. It's a rotational role. Wendy Lucas-Bull, and then Tony O'Lane, and Tony plays a major role in chairing the De Beers Fund, which is also a trustee of the Panaharic De Beers Fund and Trust. We then created 3 trusts to address specific problems, and these trusts benefit out of dividends and do their work through that. The Disadvantaged Women Trust, the Disabled People Trust, and then a community trust. And you can see the shareholding there. And again, these trusts are active in the communities around the operations. We don't define our communities by distance. We define them by communities where we get our labour from. We call them our labour sending areas. In some cases, they're pretty close to our operations. And in other instances, like Blouberg in the Limpopo province, they're quite a distance away, but large numbers of our labour comes from those areas. So that is the way that our BE deal is structured. Then if we look at our purchasing, and I'll show you another graph on this as well, but if we look at HDSA owned, that is, we're sharing on more than 50%, 35% of our expenditure are spent with HDSA owned companies. HDSA empowered, that is between 25 and 50% ownership, 32%, and then influenced for between 5 and 25%. Our spend there is 5%, and then white owned 28%. We're a founder member of the South African Supplier Diversity Council. We serve on their board, and they assist us in our attempt to broaden the base that we buy from, and very specifically in assisting us to drive more of our expenditure to our mining communities, and that is part of our localization drive in terms of spend. I can tell you that year to date, this year, that 96% of our spend in De Beers was proudly South African. This is how we've driven it up, and again, you can see the green bar that HDSA earned and empowered with influence on top. And we've had significant successes from 2009 onwards. And that one is attributed to suppliers to transform themselves. And then we've also started a series of what we call supply days, where ourselves and skilled people from Sable will put supply days or host supply days in the areas where we are active, and then workshop with them. You know, how do they interact with us? How do they access our purchasing? And then more importantly, how do they transform themselves? So many of our suppliers that were previously white-owned, we assisted in transforming them to where they fall within the categories, hence the significant rise in the percentages that you see here. Just a few pictures. We're a fairly small company with a few good-looking people at the top and one not so good-looking at the bottom, but there's our head of human relations, Sakini, that is sitting here with you, our chief operating officer, our chief financial officer, and then Mani DiPietro as the Panahari director serving on EXCO at the moment. And before you ask the question, yes, there is not a female on our EXCO, and that is a concern to us. The person has been identified as being developed, and it is a big drive for us to transform our executive committee further as well. These are the pictures of our general managers of our Kimberley Mines operation. Finch Mine, Maxwell, South African mining engineer. He was earmarked to go to Venetia, but as part of his career development, opted to go to Canada for a 2 to 3 year stint, where he will be managing Snap Lake, which is one of our major mines in Canada, and you know, hopefully will return to South Africa to manage one of our mines or to become the chief operating officer and later on be in line to become the chief executive officer. So we are at the moment recruiting a general manager for Venetia Mine. Fuspid Mine, Fumi Zikalola, those of you that have met in Fumi, you know, would have met a lady that is no token appointment. It was a lady who became a general manager at the age of 28. She managed Kimberley Mines, which is one of the easier operations to manage, for about 2 years, and we then put her into Fuspid, where we had major problems to turn that mine around, and she did. So here's somebody to watch, somebody that all the other mining companies hands off. She's not in the market, as she has got places to go in De Beers. And then Christy Bisani looking after the Macroland and our heritage areas. Employment equity, and we do have the numbers available should you require more. Those are the percentages, especially senior management, an area we were hurt during the downturn because we did restructure fairly significantly at the time. But then an area that we are proud of is our women in mining. Is an area we are doing well, and we are growing rapidly as we are developing and investing in female mining engineers, metallurgists, geologists, at the operator level. So you'll find at our mines many females operating large pieces of earth moving equipment, etc. And then Sakini will deal a little bit later with people with disability, but we had a major drive to find people, assist them, you know, in preparing themselves for employment. And the drive came really at Fuspid Mine, where we ran a pilot, and there we're just under 4% of our labour complement at the moment are occupied by people with disability. And these are not people just sitting in an office. You know, these are people that work in public and corporate affairs, people that sort diamonds, and we've even got two people who were trained as artisans, you know, working in workshops with their form of disability, where although they can't go out and work in the field, they can practice their trade in a workshop environment. So quite a few lessons for our other minds to learn from that. We've also put some material together. We'll be assisting other companies to benefit from what we've learned to transport and export the recipe that we found to ensure that we as a country employ more people with disability and look after those special people much better. Just a few pictures, because as the honourable members commented, you know, pictures tell a story, and it's not always just the good pictures. One has got to look at the bad ones as well. But here, a number of people where you can see them active in the mining environment, and certainly not office bound, but out in the field, in our operations. I'm going to ask Sakili to take over the next part of the presentation. Thank you, Sakili.
Honourable members, thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, Philip. I would like to just comment on the point about tokenism within the mining industry. You know, I have heard many people talking about some individuals that are tokens. I want to confirm, Chair, that I'm not token myself. I have two master's degrees, and I'm busy finishing a PhD, and I don't know anyone who will spend so many years firming up his career and focusing on turning around companies and making an impact, which I believe I do, can be coined as a token going forward. Of course, I'm aware there are challenges. There are some individuals that might want to be taking an easy way around to try and comply, but I can confirm it's BS, it's not the culture. And going forward, some of you, Chair, have met with some of my colleagues that are running mines, that are turning around operations, that are role models, and I think we must be proud of the impact that transformation has made within the mining industry, because I know I wouldn't be in this industry if it was not because of transformation. But it was not just transformation, it was also the drive from some of us, like myself. You know, I went to university to ensure that I've got the right qualifications and I remain very relevant. Coming into human resource development, we are spending a lot of time and resources into that space. If I can just cite one or two key investments in that space, we are looking very actively in terms of spending money in terms of our colleagues that are historically disadvantaged. We're spending 5.5% of our payroll into emancipation and empowerment of our colleagues, and of course last year we spent more than 60 million rand just ensuring that we empower our colleagues in all sectors. You know, as you can see in the graph, you've got learnership, you've got artisans and apprentices, you've got AVET, and we also provide bursaries, and we also spend a lot of time working with communities in the same vein, of which my colleague therefore, who's my voter and running the program, will talk to us about. But something fundamental about human resource development, it's about, you know, some of the work we're doing with our technical training center in Kimberley. We tried to call it a university. The education system of South Africa did not allow us to call it a university. But we believe the future is about training in a technical skills and ensuring that we up in numbers and hopefully double the size of the artisans looking into the future opportunities in terms of mining and so on. I'm going to ask my colleague therefore to talk on some of the community related human resource development programs.
Thank you, Chair, members of the portfolio committee, ladies and gentlemen. Some of the programs that we engage in that are key to us assisting in sustainable development in our community are fundamental to areas of mathematics and science, through which we can then be able to develop the required skills, not only for our industry, but also in particular around the local government that we have around our mind. We are engaged in partnerships with the universities in terms of running these programs, for instance, University of Johannesburg, the Valley University of Technology, where we then are able to use their premises to be able to run these programs, expose the youngsters to the life at university and environment, but also to be able to use the facilities at universities like laboratories, science laboratories, computer laboratories, libraries at the university, so that we can be able then to have the youngsters ready for tertiary education. We have a program that we run from our Johannesburg office within the areas around Gauteng. We have a program that we run in North Limpopo around Nishia Mine, that is in Musina and the Pokong area, including the Venda area. We also have a program that we run in Kronstadt and Barre in the Free State, as well as a program that we run in Kimberley. Besides these programs on math and science development, we also have a program over and above our Basel profile. We have in partnership with the universities as well as NEFSA, running again a program where we then have been supporting students starting in 2008. And running through to currently, we started with 86 students. We are now this year at 375 students, and we expect 132 of those to be completing their university education this year. In terms of mind community development, this is a slide that talks to is developed around the mining charter framework, and talking to, for instance, the programs that we run in communities. Before we could engage in our communities as well as labor sending areas, we have a program that we run with our sister company as well, Anglo, called FIT, where we are able to go into a community, conduct research, be able to find the framework as well as the profile of the area, including activities and actions that the municipalities also play in that particular role. In some of the areas, for instance, where we have the chiefs presiding over a particular role, we are able to engage and also talk to the programs of action from the municipalities as well as from the chieftainships. Among others, we learn and pick up from the IDP programs, playing a role as members of committees in those municipalities, so that these processes could then be able to inform, among others, our labor, social labor plans. We, as you see, we have an expenditure of 23 million rand that we invest in communities through our DPS fund, and these are projects that are around corporate social responsibility and corporate social investment throughout areas around which we operate. And this basically talks to about 2.3% of our net profit after tax. These are some of the engagements that we have been running. For instance, in Limpopo, we have been running in partnership with the Department of Education a program called Rural Schools Program. Through this program, we have been able to build about 16 schools in areas where before we had trees existing as schools, or structures that really were not anywhere near demonstrating a school structure being facilities that youngsters were using. And these are some of the photographs of examples from when we touched these communities and after our partnerships and relationships with this community. Some of the investments in infrastructure development, for instance, in Kroonstad, where among others we engage in programs of building tar roads, or also being involved in roads or pathways that we have been able to pay.
If I can just talk about the housing, I must just maybe first make a point that we seem to be as we do not have hostels. You know, you've seen our numbers, we do not employ as many people as some of our colleagues that are here, and we try by all means to not to impact on family livelihood systems, you know, by moving various members of the community outside of their normal environment. We have, wherever we had hostels, like in our Finch mine, we have spent a lot of money in the last 5 years to convert that hostel into a family-based type field. We continue to engage with NUM in terms of opportunities for us to facilitate housing opportunities, as well as various other requirements that our communities or our employees will be faced. We continue to bus people in and out. In some cases, we bus our employees for about 80 kilometers, like in our Messina environment, in our Venetia mine. Philip.
Thank you. Safety in the mining industry is probably the most important thing, and we probably should have started with this slide, so my apologies, because it is safety first before anything else. I'm glad to sit here in front of you, and we don't talk about reducing fatalities in De Beers Consolidated Mines, because it has now been 3 years since we've last had a fatality, and as the CEO of DBCM, you know, that is something that will not and cannot happen on my team's watch. We do unfortunately still injure people, and we've injured far too many people this year to date in our quest of mining diamonds. And again, this comes back to our living up to diamonds. We cannot put that symbol of emotion out there, and attached with that comes the view that somebody gave his or her life in delivering that diamond, or that somebody was injured in delivering that diamond. Hence, our full belief and our strive towards zero harm. So you can see there the 5 injuries that we had this year, and they're all unnecessary. 2 at Venetia, or 1 at Venetia mine. That was a chemical explosion which shouldn't have happened, where the person received light burns but fully recovered.
The color coding
there, we really measure ourselves against ourselves. So we perform worse than we did previously. We immediately turn that in a red. And you can see there, first bit mine. Last year to date, we've had 1 injury to go across the top line. This year to date, we had 2. We've got other leading indicators that we look at as well. And that immediately is a red flag to put a lot more effort into our safety program at Whispered Mine. Those are 2 contract employees that got injured from the same company. And, you know, we've engaged with that company in our interaction with them to improve our security, our safety drive with them, and for them to take ownership and work with us to improve the safety. I won't dwell on those injuries anymore. You look at first case and medical treatment cases, again there, you know, start increasing at Kimberley. So again, an area where we put a lot of focus, and if somebody picks up a little cut, it might have been more serious. So it's an indicator that things are not going well. And then, we also track our damage incidents, because it also talks to compliance, talks to behaviour, and inform our analysis and our actions. And then very important are those big numbers that we see at the bottom, 7,000, 3,000, and 49, what do we call our visible foul leadership interactions, near hits, etc. That is where somebody sees something that potentially can be unsafe. Or an action, somebody walking down a staircase talking on his cell phone. Somebody walking down a staircase, we call it the 3-point contact in a plant. Both hands on the rails, 1 foot on the ground. So if somebody sees that not happening, we document that. We expect the person to coach his colleague, not to reprimand him, but to coach him, to say that if you don't follow it, you are going to fall. And then we start picking these trends up, and we see that people are not following the rules that they should in terms of, let's call it in this example, staircases. And we then focus on that broadly across the company to try and drive that behavior home. So those numbers there, one don't want them too big, but the bigger they get, the more we believe that people are not just only taking ownership and accountability for their own safety, but they also become thy brother's keeper in looking out for each other, and that is how we are growing and building our safety culture in the business. So Kenny, if you can take us through the AIDS and wider health.
And the health care of our employees is a fundamental focus for us. And hence, as a company, we are the first company to actually issue ARVs, not just to our employees, but also to departments. And I'm aware that some of the other mining companies started following us. They believe it was the right thing for us to do. We do not have major incidents. I was just going through a major health incident within our company. We are not exposing our employees to as many health care related incidents like many other mining companies. Of course, we do look after for issues like TB. There's one case on asbestos, but it's not in South Africa, it's in our Botswana business. There's an issue on one of our Scanex machines in our Botswana operation. So in general, in South Africa, we do not have major incidents. And of course, our colleagues that are dedicated in looking after this area, they continuously monitor the possible incidents that could be facing our business. Moving into the environmental space, it's an area where we did not score all the points. If you look at our scorecard in the beginning, purely because there are some areas where we're busy with amendments in terms of our environmental management plan. I can cite two operations where we have submitted or lodged the amendments in our environmental management plan. In the Makwaland mines, we have made significant changes in our environmental management plan, and we have submitted that information, and we are engaging actively with our communities, with the NGOs, as well as with government, in order to be able to come up with a well-aligned environmental management plan that will ensure that we live up to the demands. In terms of some of the issues, in terms of our financial provision, there are some gaps within our operations, especially in the older operations like in Namakwaland and Kimberley, but it's something we continuously to engage with our colleagues within DMR to resolve going forward. But in general, environmental management within our company is a fundamental, critical focus area, and we continuously look at ways to remain relevant. Moving into sample analysis, I would probably ask Philip to talk a little bit about our interest and our commitment into exploration in the country. And it's something that we are very hopeful. We believe that South Africa remains prospective, and we continuously invest resources to find those mines. It's unfortunate that the size of our business over the last 3 years has dramatically changed. In 2007, we produced 15 million carats. This year, we are looking at about 66 million carats. So we are no longer the same size that we were, and hence there has been a number of implications in terms of how many people we're employing and where our footprint is in South Africa. Philip.
Now, the big drive, one is exploration. The other one is to look at our existing mines, hence the investment that we'll talk a little bit later on in Venetia mine. Also the efforts that we've got in Kimberley mines, a lot of tailing resources left in the area that are not payable at the moment. As we become more efficient, more productive and drive our cost per ton down, we'll bring more of those tailing resources in. And there's one dump in particular that's got a 12-year life. And we've got our sights focused on that particular dam to get a cost structure in place that will make that viable and by itself extend the life of our Kimberley operation by a further 12 years. At our first put mine, we're also looking at the ore body below the current levels of working, and again, if we find a way of economically extracting that, it will add a further 6 to 7 years to the life of first put mine. So those are around our existing mines. Then another mine that is probably out there are us improving our security and curtailing, you know, people that try and benefit from what we work hard for to get. So in other words, those that are stealing our diamonds. And you know, we believe that is quite significant. And my chairman always talk about the Johnny Walker diamonds. You know, they develop legs and they keep on walking. So it's our job to try and curtail that and bring that benefit back, which will significantly add the current production that we produce. And then lastly, a lot of focus on exploration. Many of the major diamond companies in the world don't see South Africa as that perspective from a diamond point of view. We still firmly believe in exploration for diamonds in South Africa. We've got a database that we've built up over many years that goes back based on more modern exploration techniques to about the mid-1950s. So we've actually gone back to that database. We believe that all the easy mines to find has been found. We believe that a mine is hiding somewhere in all of that data that we've gathered over the years. And we're reworking through all of that to try and find those, the needle in the haystack that we might have missed before. So there's a few pictures of work that we've done, some interesting anomalies that we found, and we've just completed, again, if there's a perception that we're leaving the country, we've just flown a massive area of ground around Finch Mine where we spent over 3 million rand just on the flying program to try and identify anomalies that we'll hopefully drill next year to again try and find another diamond mine. So we are firmly believing in finding De Beers' next diamond mine in South Africa.
If I can move on to beneficiation. Beneficiation is a major focus area for us as De Beers. I can cite a couple of initiatives that we're running as a company. We are actively involved in various training programs. We are actively involved in encouraging local designers to design various strategic pieces in South Africa that we then showcase around the world as part of creating consumer confidence and creating demand for the product, especially in strategic markets like in China and in India, as well as in the U.S., which is responsible for about 40% of our sales globally. We are in partnership with the government of the Northern Cape in building what I call Southern African Kimberley International Diamond and Jewelry Academy. It's something that we have made a lot of progress. As I speak to you on Friday, we will be officially opening this academy, which will be focused on training cutters and polishers and creating more opportunities in that space. We are also actively involved in the marketing of diamonds in South Africa. We ran a Kaya brand campaign, which ran for about 3 years in South Africa with a lot of success for the retail entities within the diamond within the diamond industry. And we are about to launch a Forever Mark product or brand in South Africa, which we've just launched in strategic markets like in US, in China, in Japan, in India, and we are looking into doing something similar here in South Africa before the end of this year. Something fundamental about beneficiation is the fact that we're selling 40% by value of the diamonds that are produced in South Africa to the local cutters and polishers. Of course, there are some challenges in terms of some categories of those diamonds, and hence among ourselves with DMR and the regulator, we are looking at creative ways we can begin to address and deal with some of those issues. And those issues could range from a strategy to make sure that industrial diamonds can be beneficiated in South Africa, a strategy to ensure that some of the people that cut and polish in South Africa, they truly cut and polish in South Africa. And this is ongoing work that we're doing among ourselves and the Chamber of Mines, the Diamond Task Team, together with the regulator, with a lot of guidance and advice from the Department of Mineral Resources. If I can just show some of the numbers in terms of how much we've sold in South Africa to the beneficiators or to the site holders or to our clients, we have sold over the last 10 years an average of about 42%. It's something that we are excited about, and it's also something that has been legislated by the Department of Mineral Resources in order to ensure that indeed beneficiation does happen in South Africa. We are proud of our relationship with the state diamond trader. We continue to sell to the state diamond trader. If I can cite a number for last year, we sold about 735,000 carats to the state diamond trader, almost a million, to the value of about $76 million US dollars. And it's something we continue to look into going forward. Forever Mark, I've spoken about Forever Mark. It is coming to South Africa, and I'll encourage the honorable members to look for this product. We have struck a partnership with African Romance, which is an empowered jewelry entity that will be distributing this product in South Africa, which is a very special product for us. And what we're doing with this product is something that other industries have done, like apparel industry, Louis Vuitton has done something similar, and other industries have done something similar. As I speak, Chair, we are running a reality show program, and I'm sure you can see the pretty pictures. This is a partnership between us and Umzansi Magic, which is one of the DSTV channels in South Africa. The first premiere was on last night at 7 p.m., and it will be on until end of January. And I would like to encourage the members to look into what we're doing with this program. We're looking at finding what I call Kim Kardashian of South Africa. In the past, we have used models from U.S. and elsewhere in the world. This time around, we said we will find a Kim Kardashian in South Africa. I'm aware that some of the members may not know who Kim is. I'm not sure, Honorable Chair, if the members are also on Twitter, because I'm told that Kim, she's the fifth individual that is followed in terms of the numbers of people without being a singer or anything else. And she's one of the Diamond Angels, and she was in South Africa to showcase the good that diamonds do, which is something fundamental in terms of consumer confidence around the world. And I would like to be inviting the honorable members to join us where possible, Chair, when we do the final selection of the winner. And the winner will be winning a modeling contract, a car, bursary opportunity, and an opportunity to represent the good that diamonds do around the world. We're working in partnership with Kim Kardashian, of course, as our current Diamond Angel. We've got Flabiana. We have a number of very influential and very popular people around the world that are driving this message going forward. The next question that the honorable member was asking to our parent company or to our colleagues or our shareholder, major shareholder, Anglo-American, was around job creation. As a company, we know that the industry might have not done enough to create as many jobs as possible, especially for younger people, of course, people younger than myself, in ensuring that they have hope and they've got opportunities going forward. In the past, in DBS, we used to run a program called Matla Falang, and Matla Falang was solely focused on BEE-type entities. You know, we've created multi-million rand entities and individuals that are millionaires and billionaires. But through that program, we did not reach out to the ordinary people on the street. And hence, we have adopted DBS or the Anglo-American Zimele model. We have a target of creating 5,000 jobs in the next 3 years in DBS. We started this program about a year and a half ago. So far, we have funded about 106 companies. We have employed about 600 people. And these companies are mainly owned by young people. 50% of these companies are owned by young people, and 36% of these companies are owned by women. The recovery rate, ours is a lot better than Angle, 92%. Maybe it's because of our size, and we've dispersed about 15 million rand. I can confirm, honorable members, that we have entered into a partnership with IDC. Our funding going forward is going to be up to 100 million rand, and we have created 5 of these hubs in strategic areas where our business is found. We have one in Kimberley, and we have a structure. We have an office, we have internet, we have a business support facility, and so on. And we've got one in Kroonstad, we've got one in Johannesburg in Springs, which is part of our Element 6 business, and we've got one in Messina, and we've got one at Clancy. And in all of these areas, the biggest challenge is unemployment, and the big challenge is the alternative opportunities. As a company, we've realized that we are not going to be creating more jobs directly through mining, and hence we've embarked on this very extensive program to encourage our colleagues to look into this area. In terms of the kind of businesses we're supporting, they range from a number of projects. We've got driving schools, we've got nappy shops, we've got a range of programs that the communities are excited about. But something fundamental in terms of our enterprise development is not just about looking at these SME, but it's also looking at these manufacturing or high-impact type projects. And hence, we've embarked on a program where we said, because we own so much land, what can we do to ensure that some parts of our land is utilized to create alternative industries? We have done an extensive feasibility study work in various areas where we're mining, especially in Namaqualand and in Kimberley. We have just signed on Eskom to come and build 300 megawatts in the next 5 years. We've sold them a farm. They will be making an investment of about 3 billion rand. We've also signed various IPPs to do something similar. They'll be spending up to 5 billion rand in the next 5 years. And we're doing something similar in Kimberley with a solar park. We've assigned the land to establish a solar park. And we've gone out, we went on tender to call for investors to come and put money into Kimberley in the space of solar energy. And I'm proud to say, Chairman, that we have signed a number of three of these IPPs, and they have made a commitment to build about 150 megawatts of solar with an investment of about 600 million rands going into the future. Of course, it will be run in phases. It's also aligned. It has to be aligned with the refit exercise that our South African government is running through the Department of Energy. We are also looking into fisheries. We've realized that because of historical reason, we owned about 10% of the South African coast up north from where we are, Chair. And we have embarked on an extensive exercise as well there to look for investors. Currently, we have an investment of about 40 million rand from our colleagues, from our BE partners, Ponohalo, and we are talking to another investor who's about to put in 140 million rand. We have made an impact. We've built tanks. We have demarcated the land accordingly. We have aligned the opportunities in terms of job creation. Unfortunately, now there's not enough people that are employed, but we know there's potential for about 4,000 tons in Namaqualand, and we know we need up to about 600 million rand to realize that full potential, especially looking at the opportunities where there's electricity, there's opportunities because some of these areas have been mined before. We are also actively looking at other opportunities, Chair, in terms of our rehab. I may not be able to quantify exactly how many jobs we can create there, but it's an area we're looking into. We are also looking into various assets that are not strategic to us that we've sold to others where we believe there's opportunities for job creation. I'm not going to dwell much on the CSI spend. My colleague Zepo did speak about our focus on our CSI spend, which is not a legislated investment from us, from our part. It's something we do because it's the right thing for us to do. We continue to focus on education and healthcare, and you'll see a number of initiatives that we focus into going forward.
So maybe just it's clear that we spend 355 million rand on CSI over the last 10 years, and it's split in the percentages that Sikini has shared with you.
Just the last slide from my side, which is about creating other opportunities. As an industry, we've been accused of being too dominant in the mining industry, in the diamond industry, and hence, as part of our strategy change or our strategic review, we embarked on an exercise where we made a call that will focus on fewer but better assets going forward. And as a result, we've sold a number of assets. I'm sure honorable members are aware of some of these transactions that we've done. We sold Cullinan to Petra. We've sold Namaqualand. We are in the process of selling Namaqualand mine to Transex, and so on. This is purely to ensure that the diamond industry is not monopolized by one entity, but instead there's other entities that begin to benefit in terms of that. And of course, ourselves, we are not experts in mining smaller operations that have a very minimal return on investment below our threshold of about 15%. And hence, we have sold some of these entities to community groupings like in Jagersfontein, where the community owns an interest in this business, and there's greater opportunities for procurement and various other opportunities going forward. I'm now going to ask Philip to talk to our commitment to South Africa. We are here to stay, and we believe South Africa remains a home to DBS going into the future. Thank you.
Justine, to put Venetia mine in perspective, Venetia mine is probably one of the top five diamond deposits in the world, so this is purely a world-class operation. There are more diamonds left in Venetia than what we mined so far. By 20, 2020, if we don't invest in this mine, that will be the end of Venetia Mine. So with building an underground mine, you do all your development and all your investment up front, and it will take us about 7 to 8 years to build that mine. So we have, and we'll be finishing the report on the feasibility study in February, and I am taking that vote to the De Beers board in May next year to vote a project of 15 billion rand to build this mine at Venetia. That will be below what we call cut 4, so we can't do another cut. Cut 5 as an open pit is not viable. If we don't make that investment, or start making that investment at the beginning of next year, then we will have an hiatus between the open pit and the underground mine. You know, hence our drive to have that approved early next year and start the expenditure. The feasibility study by itself is about 150 million rand, so that will put on our capital book 15 billion going forward. And there are various ways in which one can mine this. This will take the life of the mine to roughly 2050. If you follow a different way of extracting it, it will be 2046. If you mine it really very hard, it will be 2042. If you follow another method, it will be 2056. So I think the future will tell us, you know, how this unfolds, but it certainly would add, you know, plus 20 years to the life of Venetia, and therefore plus 20 years to the life of DBCM. You know, more than enough to provide both Sekedi, Tsepo and myself with employment until we retire. And I can assure the honourable members that I've got no intention to go and work for De Beers anywhere else in the world other than in South Africa. So I've got a personal interest in ensuring that De Beers stay in South Africa as well. Thank you very much. That is our presentation. So we'll very gladly take your questions. The easy ones we'll answer now, and the difficult ones we'll promise to come back to you in writing.
Thank you very much, honourable members. That was De Beers. We thought you would be shorter and brief, but indeed the subject matter we're discussing is very important. And so the passion that you have shown is understandable. That's why I didn't stop you midway, because you needed to tell your story yourselves.
Thank you.
Let's then allow members to engage and yes, and say what to do thereafter. Honourable Lucas, I see your hand is up. Honourable Bigani, Honourable Khululu, Honourable Sonto. Over to you, sir.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. I think I'm pleased to hear that you're not pulling out of South Africa, because that was a great concern when I heard this morning, because that would be a big blow. I know you went through very difficult times in the economy downturn, and I thought maybe that has been pushing you, but nevertheless, you're still staying with us. And it's also pleasing to know that you're continuing with the education issue. There's one of your major things that you've done in KwaZulu-Natal was the Mangosuthu Technikon, and those were difficult times. And I'm sure that now when things are much better, we have a democratic country, you can do much more, because that was highly appreciated. It's also good to hear that you're coming back, because Kimberley employed many people in the days gone by. And if you're coming back with this Kimberley International Diamond Academy, we say good, because that is a positive way to create jobs, and we seriously look forward to. The question that I would like to ask is the rehabilitation. I'm not talking about the big hole. Other than that, how are you faring?
Thank you very much.
very much, Chair. I've got a million questions, but I'll ask only one question because of the time constraints. Let me thank DPS for the nice presentation and say that really we're very happy as a committee to hear that you are not going anywhere. You are going to stay in South Africa. You are going to invest more in the country. That is very good news, I must say. But I've got a small agenda concern here, Chair, with regard to the impact of the relocation of the aggregation move from London to Botswana. Because it is said that in Botswana you are going to be with a deal of $500 million that is in rough diamonds that you are going to be selling to Botswana. Whereas on the other side, the state diamond trader last financial year accessed something like $109. Now, I don't understand, because it looks like you are going to be investing more that side. What is it that you are not doing right here, that you are splashing more money that side, and on this side you are not spending more? To me, it gives me a doubt a bit that no, in the foreseeable future, you are going to settle in Botswana. You are going to leave us here in South Africa. Can I hear a comment about that one, actually? It would be very, very useful for us to know about that one. I think that is all that I wanted to ask. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Bivani.
Chairperson, before I say anything, can I just suggest that in future, when we have these platforms, I know that we are going to have a second opportunity with the different companies, but I think it's time that we do also indicate that we, our way of asking questions and where we're going to with the said companies is not very effective because of our time constraints. Can we perhaps in future have such a platform, possibly at a different venue, and possibly with the availability of more hours? Otherwise, we're not going to benefit out of what we're doing. Just to mention.
Next Wednesday's session is the whole day. And we can talk about the venue. But on Wednesday, today's session has been shortened because the Deputy President is speaking in the House. That was the only reason why we couldn't get the whole day. But rest assured, the one of next Wednesday is the whole day. Surely we will endeavor that the following one, because it's clear now that we will need another session. It will also be longer.
Thank you, Chair. My first question is on slide 3, on the map. I see there you have something, SASA, S-A-S-A. I take it that that's towards the shores of the Far West. Now, we've had an incident, for example, where we have people who complained to the committee that they are not getting a fair share or a fair involvement in terms of marine mining in the said coastline there. I don't remember. I think they were towards, I don't remember the town they were coming from, but they were from somewhere that side, where you have a situation where they are actually in a way being abused to go and do deep sea diving, mine these minerals, take them out, and then people like yourselves just come, backdoor buying, gone, and they've got nothing. Can you put my mind straight in relation to that? And in terms of development for marine mining, what assurance or in fact, what relationship, perhaps I should say, do you possibly have with government to ensure that this that type of mining develops successfully to the advantage of our own country, as we are about to stay for life an extra 123 years within South Africa? Then the scorecard on the, what page is it? I think it's slide 4. I appreciate this scorecard, but I could possibly be having a problem in the sense that the breakdown doesn't give much of a picture in terms of your women, disabled, different social, racial groups, and how they are best placed in the company. So having a round figure, for example, there, such as employment equity, is not really saying much in terms of your commitment or your keeping up to part of your social plans and even perhaps to the mining charter in terms of how these people benefit or what opportunities are really visible to prove to us there's improvement in life. It's the same for human resource development, for example, community development. Now, there in housing and living conditions, I don't know what you mean by saying that that's not applicable in terms of this table, because it's one of our concerned areas that when we go to these areas, we said it to the previous group, the previous company, to Anglo, that you go to these areas and the actual picture is not what we see. Yes, you might say that you've minimized hostels and so on, but living conditions are definitely not of a standard that you would say is satisfactory in showing that there's an improvement of life for these people who are working in the companies in the mining industry. The same goes with the one on slide, I'll take it that it's slide 16, it's not numbered, where you have your mine community development report for the year. You might say yes to some of these questions that are being asked here, but it also still doesn't say anything in terms of the level of progress that you have made. So I don't know what are the possibilities of you possibly sending something that is more detailed than that, because you might even find that it's a situation where this type of graphs or scorecards are not really effective in proving anything to ourselves. The same goes for the environmental management compliance report for the year. It's almost as if you just ask a question that you think we might ask, and the answer would be yes, but it says nothing beyond that that is really proving what we need to know. Then the other thing, you mentioned something about a school not having been recognized as a university. Is it perhaps because you are not meeting the relevant criteria, appreciating your qualifications, sir, but we need more of you. We need to know more of you. Where are they and who are they? And if you're not meeting the relevant criteria, having that school, this is where I would then ask, out of what government has to assist you in terms of the CETAs, are you then not able to meet that criteria to ensure that that school reaches the relevant standards that are required to become a university? And in terms of the money you are making, quite frankly, I don't see why you can't afford to come up to that standard and have more employees and then or learners. And then in terms of the academy, how are these people able to sustain themselves? Where do they end up? Because after a certain cycle, I'm sure you should be having new learners. And every time you have new learners, what are the gains that they have out of that, and where do they end up? Chair, I don't know. I'm not... Okay, the slide on the abalone, the project. This project, it's obviously got nothing to do with mining, but it's got something to do with, in particular, in Namaqualand. Now, it's also a mining area, we know. But in terms of gains, what was the idea of this project, and who are the owners of this project? Who are the actual owners of this project for us to get an understanding as to whether it's really a community-based project that is meant to benefit that particular community? One of the key questions I'd like to ask Chairperson, I think, not prolonging myself, is your relationship with government and in terms of, and the communities concerned, where you have your minds when it comes to the issue of royalties. Where do you stand in your commitment in terms of payments of royalties? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sonda.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm impressed by your concluding quotation. And it is true. That is why today you are here. I'm also happy that you dispel these rumors that the company is about to leave the country. I once heard a man saying to another, until I see the wounds in your hands, then I'll believe. So to me, therefore, seeing will be believing, because where there is smoke, they say there is always fire. Let me fire them. Your slide 3, you were indicating to you that Finch has changed hands. Now, my question would be, how did that affect your workforce? Because we had a lot of complaints about how that process was taken through. I am raising this on the basis of job security and sustainable jobs within your company. The other one would be I want to be quicker than you. I was seeing Zimele on the what's name on Anglo, and I see Zimele in you. It reminded me of a subject we, in fact, of the manner in which we used to buy to write our history. Bismarck here, Bismarck there, Bismarck everywhere. So it's Zimele here, Zimele there, Zimele everywhere. Can you explain what's the connection there? Also, I am not sure why on your you didn't score any points on your environmental environmental management compliance report for this year, and one would want to know the reason why, because I've lifted a few issues there. Rehabilitation, which was already rehabilitation and concurrent rehabilitation, has already been mentioned earlier by one comrade. And compliance with ethics of environment as a whole. And really, you didn't score on that one. Is there any reason why you did not score on that one? If any, what are you going to do about that? I'm impressed by you making arrangements and strategies of job creation that would be sustained. But I would want to know, when are you starting with that, those intentions that are contained in your job creation and sustainability slide? Lastly, on your on the types of SMMEs you fund, it's quite a lot, but there are those that are marked with asterisks. What's the difference between those and those that are not marked with asterisks next to them? That's slide 33. I think that would be the last one, Sir President. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Would you care to respond to those, TBS?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think the first question, and there were a number of questions around rehabilitation and the environment, and I think the question was around how. And over the years here, we learned a few lessons. And you know, I would like to invite the Portfolio Committee to go and look at the Oaks mine. It is a mine that we operate. We opened it. We built it with rehabilitation in mind. We rehabilitated that mine, and the rehabilitation is complete. We've not received a closure certificate on it yet, but that is, with the knowledge that we've got today, I think a case study that we would want to refer, you know, most of our mining colleagues to. We would like to refer the Portfolio Committee to it as what is the DMR. And those lessons, you know, we couldn't follow any other mines because not every mine was built with rehabilitation in mind. So when we start, so that is the one extreme, you know, on the one side. And then the old mines, like Kimberley and the Makarand mines, are on the other side. You know, those were, you know, bless their souls, our forefathers that started, you know, mining with, you know, no rehabilitation in mind at the time. So there we are playing catch-up. So if we look at what we are doing, you know, at the Makarand mines, we are doing rehabilitation. And then we're also looking at alternative land use. You know, how can one use that? What are the alternatives to the rehabilitation, where the cost of rehabilitation sometimes far outweigh the you know, the economic benefit that can be derived from rehabilitating that land? And there's got to be a balance in terms of money that one spends on historical rehabilitation, and what other use can one do or can one have with that money to have an impact on the community life. So that's on that side of the equation, the work that we're doing. And then at mines like Venetia, Firstfoot, who sort of sit in the middle, those we've introduced a process of concurrent rehabilitation. In most of those cases, we've caught up on the backlog that we had at Firstfoot in Venetia. We're concurrently rehabilitating, and the program is designed such that the day that you finished mining, you are just about completed with your rehabilitation. So I think on that point, we've got mines in every one of those categories. One, the Oaks built with rehabilitation in mind and fully rehabilitated. Your old mines, where there's catch-up, and one is going to look at a combination of the two, and then our mines, Venetia, Whispered, we, you know, we've introduced concurrent rehabilitation, and we'll catch that up.
The follow-up, Chief. And what is your financial budget, or your outlook in terms of budget, in the involvement of rehabilitation of mines that you have?
I'm going to have to get back to you on that, but our total rehabilitation liability, all inclusive, is in the region of 1.2 billion rand. As my colleague has indicated, you know, at all mines, but two of them, those are fully, either fully funded or fully guaranteed, and we have just secured guarantees to ensure that we fully guarantee all our commitments. So there are financial backing behind the 1.2 billion to ensure that we do follow our full rehabilitation responsibility.
Chair, that I seem to be hampering on one thing, but it's also still around that. Just to determine if you most probably one of the companies that own a lot of property around Gauteng and Limpopo. Is that still a mining area, or is that just area that's possibly involved in rehabilitation, or is it something else? What is that land used for?
Okay, I can run through it pretty quickly. We own very little land in Gauteng. We're DBCM. I don't want to call it squat, but we utilise the building of one of our sister companies, De Beers Group Services, which is an office block in the south of Johannesburg. So no property owned in the Gauteng region. In the Venetia region, the mining area consists of about 3,000 hectares, and of those 3,000 hectares, probably about less than 10% of that is actually disturbed by the mining activity. So that is the portion that one has got to rehabilitate, because your diamond parts have actually got a fairly small footprint, and will be it's much easier to rehabilitate. Around Venetia, we've secured 32,000 hectares on which we are working towards the government's drive of enlarging our protected areas, our conservation areas, and in that 32,000 hectares is run and managed as a nature reserve. It currently has got about 120 elephant on, rhinoceros, lion, and he is part of our contribution to conserving areas in Limpopo for the next generations to come. In the Kimberley area, we've got three areas where we've got conservancies there. The one is 42,000 hectares in size. There's a mining right in there, a small area that we're currently mining. And then two other areas, each just over 10,000 hectares, and all of those have been in De Beers' ownership for almost as old as the company is, of over 100 years, and have been conserved for many years again as part of conserving a larger part of this country as conservation. First Put mining area is fairly small. That's the only property that we own in that area. And then in the Makwaland, we owned a total of about 300,000 hectares, of which just more than half of that is the mining area. Now again, not all of that has been mined, a fairly small part of that has been mined, and that is have to be rehabilitated. So that forms, that plus 150,000 hectares forms part of the sale of the mine to Transhex. Then of the remaining portion that is left there, a large part of that has been leased to Sandparks to increase their reserve in that area on a 99-year lease. And then the remaining of the properties after that is either being sold to the current tenants, because again, in the Makwaland, many of those tenants have rented those mines for many, many years, generation after generation from De Beers, and then large parts of those have also been donated to the communities in and around Glanseer and Koengnos. So we've got a holistic land plan where we're retaining those properties that we require for mining, where it's part of our mining areas described by the mining rights. We're retaining and managing those properties which we're conserving for our next generations, and then the rest of those properties we have embarked on a plan of disposing of those, be it on commercial terms or be it through donation. I can also add that we had a piece of land, about 35,000 hectares in extent, just outside Kimberley, which we have sold to the Northern Cape government as part of a project of establishing emerging farmers on that particular area. Just to continue with, I think there was a...
So is it, you confirm the claims that De Beers is the second biggest landowner after the state?
We are rapidly reducing size in terms of land holding, but we're doing it in a responsible way. And as I said, we've drafted a land management plan. And, you know, in the areas where we've disposed of land, most of this has been in the Northern Cape, and where we want to dispose land, we formed a team and we've worked very closely with the Northern Cape government in terms of how do we deal with this land and reduce our footprint as landowners in South Africa.
Can we get that information? Well, it's very important that you're saying you would be disposing, you know, some of this land in a very responsible manner and retaining the land that you are still going to mine in, so that we can then have a feel and understanding
given
the history of DBS in the country. When did you start? In the 18th century?
We started on the 12th of March, 1888.
Yes.
Can I put a right as a person? A writer would be, what is this practice of you creating game farms or game wild game areas? I'm raising this because I have a suspicion, I stand corrected, that in the land that you are putting those games, you are pitching us against environmentalists because there are minerals there. There will come a time that we will say we want those minerals that are in those game farms or wild game reserves. What is this practice and where is it taking us?
Honourable Member, just in response, none of these have been declared protected areas. So that means that whoever believes, you know, that there are mineral rights on those properties can, and they do apply for prospecting permits, and if they find something, they do apply for mining rights. We've had prospecting rights on Rayput, one of the major farms outside Kimberley. We've converted that into a mining right, and I'm quite happy to share our view with this portfolio committee, you know, that it is fairly small, a very small deposit. So I know there are stories out there that we're sitting on, you know, another five Venetias that we are hiding in our game reserves. And again, you know, we're quite happy to make those results available. The reason why we have ourselves applied for the mining right on Rayput is to ensure that we mine that, or see that that is mined in a very responsible manner, because the 34 kilometres Vaal River riverine front or riverine forest that is left is probably the only bit of Vaal River riverine forest still intact on the whole of the Vaal River. So it's not that we're hiding diamonds. There is a pure and a strong conservation ethic you know, behind all of that. And, you know, there's an open invitation to anybody, you know, to measure us against that in terms of minerals available on these properties. I know the coal companies are quite interested in Venetia Limpopo Nature Reserve up at Messina, because that forms a part of what is seen as the Limpopo Coal Belt. And again, they, from our side, unfortunately, you know, we can't keep anybody out as part of the you know, part of the conservation. So if somebody applies for a prospecting right on it and gets a mineral right, then, you know, that overrides our efforts to conserve those tracts of land. I'm just trying to see if there's any. I think I've dealt more or less with the.
Can I maybe just take, maybe just follow up on the land issue? I'll try and be as quickly as I can.
we're in the process of finalizing what I call a land strategy. And part of that strategy talks to some of the requests that have come forward to us. We've been asked by the community of Goinas on the Klipa'i to donate land, which we've agreed to do. We have been asked to assist the Northern Cape government to donate land where this university that is to be built there will be built, and so on. So we are talking to all the stakeholders about what is it we can do to ensure that we are able to assist where we can. But it's not in our intention or future intentions to retain land just for the sake of doing so. I was with the community of Wonderklipa'i, for example, and they made it very clear that they're looking for land for agriculture, land for various other opportunities that, you know, we are willing to look into as the leadership in DBS. If I can just talk to this...
Please don't donate it to India.
I hear you, Honourable Member. If I can talk about some of the projects that I spoke about solar and I spoke about wind. One of the conditions we were selling, one of the conditions of attracting the investment into those areas was for those companies to have BEE companies, but not BEE companies that come from Johannesburg. None of the people that are here can ever benefit in those businesses. But it will be the people of Namakwaland, it will be the people of Kimberley. And it will not just be individuals, it will be the communities that live in and around where those investments will be. As I speak to you, the abalone business we have in Namakwaland, the community owns 10%. The IPPs that have applied, they've given me, applied for the purchasing agreement via the Department of Energy, they've given me commitment that up to 20% of equity of those businesses will be owned by the people of Namakwaland. So if you were to do this, the calculation, and then say, in a 5 billion rand, if a community owns 20%, what does it mean on annual returns, depending on what dividend that gets paid? It's a very significant impact that this kind of project will make to those communities. And if I can also just touch on the question about SASA and the issue from the divers, I'm aware that the honorable members received a number of complaints from the diving community up north. We've responded to them, and I'm happy to provide the honourable members with our response. We do not own any concessions where the divers are currently mining, because our SASA business is about 15 kilometres offshore, and the areas they're interested in is within 500 metres in terms of where the coastline is. And currently, the major owner of those concessions it's sitting with Transnet.
And, you know, just a correction, Honourable Member, we do not buy any diamonds from those divers.
Thank you. In terms of the connection with De Beers and Zimele, you know, they just given us a lot of cash when we're in serious cash constraints as part of the rights issue that we've announced about a year ago. You know, if there's best practice within Anglo, you know, why not use it? You know, I believe that Anglo have developed something for the last 20 years that works. They've got systems, they've got proper assessment criteria that they use to look into these businesses. And we felt, you know, it's the right thing for us to align ourselves and do the right things that they've done. I've seen a lot of these developmental financial institutions. You know, I can quote Itala Bank, for example. They've got a loan book of more than 500 million rand. Their recovery rate is less than 20%. You know, Anglo, for the last 15 years, they're sitting with a recovery rate of more than 90%. So that is world-class, and that's best practice that I believe we should be looking into. You know, you look at NEF, you look at various similar institutions, there is no other that's anywhere close to what Anglo has been able to achieve. And why did we, you know, there was no reason for us to start something else.
So, Kitty, maybe I can just add to that is because we are piggybacking on Anglo and utilizing some of the administrative support, you know, we're in a position where we can lend money to entrepreneurs at 6% interest, which I don't think you'll find anywhere else, because traditionally, you know, people accessing capital for those small ventures go to your microlenders, and we all know what microlenders have to charge to cover their cost and their risk.
Just the last comment from my side. The question around the academy in Kimberley and Botswana and so on, if I can cover the academy and the technical college. We couldn't call it a university, because of various regulatory compliance requirements that we could not meet purely because of the size of the institution and the focus that we're looking into. But our intention is to align this academy, the Diamond Academy, into the university that will be built in the Northern Cape. We are hoping that through this academy, we can have people going there to do PhDs in diamond mining or diamond marketing and so on. It's something that we're continuously talking to them, and it's something we're very excited about. We're hoping that once this university is there, there will be a department, a diamond department, because I think the Northern Cape community deserves something of that significance. We've been able to convince Botswana and Namibia in locating this academy. There was an outcry, especially in Namibia, after the announcement of the move of the aggregation facility from London to Botswana, that there has to be something that we do in Namibia. Coming back to the point about whether we are about to go and locate ourselves in Botswana. Botswana is very different to South Africa. They produce 30 million carats a year. We're doing, I said, 6 million carats this year. They are very different in terms of the size of business and so on. But fundamentally, everything that we're now doing in Botswana, we've done it already in South Africa. In Botswana, we are setting up something equivalent to the State Diamond Trader. We've done it here. We've learned how to set it up between ourselves and the regulator and DMR. We've been able to work together and formulate this entity that is 100% owned by the state but is able to sell up to 10% of run-of-mine of our production. We have created a diamond trading company in Botswana, which we've done here. We do have a diamond trading company in South Africa. That is the entity that's selling to the local clients. The point about the aggregation facility, it made sense to us to relocate the aggregation facility from UK to Southern Africa. They've got the right volumes, they've got the facility, and some of my colleagues in the US found it very easy to relocate and live in Botswana. So, there is opportunities that we've been able to do here, and there's things that we've been able to do. But, we've learned so much from the experience from South Africa. And I must also thank our colleagues that are sitting at the back here, for the guidance on these very complex issues around, the trading, the issues about export issues, and so on. So, we have a very chairman, competent department that has really brought some of the things we've heard from us, the guidance for us to empower, to look for these opportunities that came solely from the department and, of course, through your office as well, Chair. Thank you.
I think maybe just one thing to add is that, we are striving for a minimum of 40% by value of local sales, local beneficiation. This deal with relocating aggregation from London still only allows approximately 15% of sales and therefore beneficiation in Botswana. So a very different situation that we've got in South Africa. A question that I want to address is the Honourable Member's question around royalties, our relationship with government. One is we've got a very good, we believe, relationship with government where we can talk very frankly and sometimes get praised and sometimes get us shown very directly on where we can do better. Yes, we are paying our royalties. Do I like paying it? I've never seen anybody, giving a tax check to the fiscus with a smile on his face. But I think we all understand the reason for the royalties and the reason why we're paying that. So I think it's a business issue for us, and we're dealing with that as such.
Can I just comment on the royalty? It, It is our wish that the payment that we make as part of our royalty payment can be utilized solely for the communities where our mines are. Because currently, this investment does not benefit our community directly, and it is our proposal to this committee, if I may be allowed to do so, to consider that into the future, that instead of the royalties being used, you know, for the national, you know, fiscal requirements, but rather the benefits, even if it's 20%, goes into the communities where these mines are. Thank you.
Just one.
They send you to represent them.
Just one response, Chair, to the issue of the trainees out of the International Jewelry Academy in Kimberley. And the question was what you know, happens to them after training. And our plans are such that out of those trainees, we will then be able to provide support, financial support to them, to be able to, among others, be able to buy diamonds, polish themselves, and then be able to sell them to the local market and international market.
Thank you. I think just in closing, there were a number of questions, you know, on our scoring, and I think those, and on an employment equity numbers, I think those will be best addressed in a written response to give you the details of those. I think the last question that I want to address here was the question around job security and the sustainability of jobs. I think one, when we look at the entrepreneurs and the jobs that we do create through the De Beers Zimele Enterprise Development Hubs, part of the assessment of those business plans and part of the reason why those businesses are successful, you know, is again based on experience that Anglo has built up over 20 years on what works and what doesn't work. And even though we've only been in that busy with that initiative for a relatively short period, we've already seen a number of our entrepreneurs, you know, coming back for a second tranche as they expand their business, that clearly demonstrates the success of those businesses. Then if I look at jobs within De Beers, you know, can one ever offer anybody employment for life? I don't think we can do that anymore today, and that is why I think it is critical that we do focus a lot of our attention and a lot of our spend on training and development. Because if we give somebody skills, you know, we give somebody the ability to be employed for life. So even, you know, beyond the beers, the person must have the skill to be employed. I think that is the best response and the best that we can arm somebody to, from a job security point of view, rather skills than trying to promise a job for life.
Thank you very much. Do you have a follow-up on that? Look at the time.
There's a lot more, Chairperson, but I know we've got... But I'm just interested in knowing what's the relationship with Petra Diamond in terms of investors and investment for that matter.
Okay, there has been numerous questions about this. We have been accused of spinning off Petra as a sort of low-cost operator, like a One Time or a Mango or a Kalula, if I can use the air carrier analogy. We've gone so far as with the union to ask Petra to open the share register to demonstrate that De Beers does not have any relationship with Petra, that we don't own any shares in Petra, our shareholders don't own any shares in Petra, and you know, I myself have looked at that share register as part of that process, and it's pretty clear that I was worried that I'm not aware of something, but I can sit here and say to you to the best of my knowledge, that nobody, or no shareholder of De Beers or De Beers itself, are holding any shares in Petra whatsoever.
Okay, honourable members, you know that I know it's a very interesting subject, but let me allow you your last question.
Thank you, Sir President. I just wanted to check your earlier response. I'm sure it was related to my question about the Finch mine. When that mine was exchanging hands, when it was changing hands, how were your workforce affected, and what did you do about that? And if those people were affected, if there were any who was affected, what happened to their houses and everything?
Okay, just in terms of Finch mine was sold to the going concern under Section 197 of the Labour Relations Act. So therefore, every employee transferred from De Beers to Petra, and Section 197 requires that everybody should transfer with the same or substantially similar benefits from De Beers to Petra. So those people transferred to Petra. Petra took over their full employment contract, so they earning the same salary, although they joined a different pension fund and a different medical society, they had to demonstrate that the benefits of those are substantially the same. As part of a process, a closed bidding process, here we caught up between the requirements of the Companies Act, because Petra was a listed concern, or is a listed concern, and so what can one, how much can you consult with your employees before? We could consult with them, tell them that the mine is being sold. We could give them the comfort of Section 197. But unfortunately, a lot of the consultation had to happen after the process, because you couldn't disclose, in terms of the Company Act requirements, some of the issues up front. So yes, there were people that are quite happy, a number of people that are very happy to have joined Petra, because that gives them security going forward. Petra has also indicated to them that they will develop the ore body below the current Block 4 that we're mining, so there will be a number of years of life left in Finch under their leadership. And then, sadly, but also maybe a feather in our cap, a number of people who really like working for De Beers and who would have liked to have continued working for De Beers, but we sold the mine, so we can't under a 197 transfer them to De Beers, because we don't have those employment opportunities. So in that way, there are just on 800 people working at Finch Mine. If we continued mining, we would have mined until 2014 and then rehabilitated the mine. And under Petra, those plus 800 jobs and the secondary industries around that has been secured for a number of years to come.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's thank De Beers and for their presentation and the engagement they've had with the portfolio committee. And again, say to you, as we have said to Anglo American, this is not the last time that we interact. Surely there would be a need for us to engage once more, hoping that you will revert back to us on the areas that you are going to respond to us in writing. And to say to both you, Anglo American, and the other companies that are still going to talk to us, on the area of job creation, we want you to demonstrate to us whether there are no possibilities on the rehabilitation obligations that you've got, where you could possibly create jobs, as well as on the tailing of your mine dumps, because we believe that there's a potential in those areas. We're sitting on a very serious potential that could yield very good results. So those who have not yet spoken, we would like them to reflect on these two areas in as far as the job creation situation is concerned. And again, ladies and gentlemen, let me profusely apologize to those companies that have not had an opportunity to address us now. The reason purely being that we are obliged to go to the House now at 2, and that what we will do at 3, or is it 3 o'clock? Oh, yeah, then we can take one more company. Is that not going to be strenuous? Yeah, we can take one more company. I thought we were going back, we were going in at 2. But those that would not be able, because we didn't want to turn this into a talk shop where you quickly run over your presentation, we ask you peripheral questions, and then we bid goodbye. This is a very serious matter that we would want to give you enough opportunity to address us in terms of what is it that you are doing in your own group or company, and also to then discuss with us, you know, the possibilities into the future around this matter. So thank you very much, De Beers. Let's get on Lonmin. Whilst Lonmin is setting up, we can have a body break of 5 minutes and come back and listen to Lonmin. I hope that those that would not be presenting, you would be the first on Wednesday next week. Let's once more really apologize. Is your next? Can you approach the bench, as they say in the what you call? Please, Lord, set yourself up.